Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com worldwide. This week, my guest may be a familiar name to many of you, especially if you're baseball fans, or maybe if almost 60 years ago you were a Fresno State basketball fan. He was a multi-talented athlete and one of the legendary coaches here in the Valley from the Pete Biden tree of coaching. Len Bordet, our guest today. You know him for his baseball exploits, but he has a history of service to our country as well, and we're just going to discuss some of his experiences in the Army during World War II. But what I'd like to do, Coach, and is start off, as I start with a lot of veterans, I like to ask people what they remember about December 7th, 1941, the day that America was drawn into World War II. You grew up in Hollister, and so you were hanging around in San Benito County on that Sunday morning?
Yes, actually, my dad, who wasn't a very good golfer, he had decided to go out with a couple of his friends to play some golf on that Sunday morning, and he took me along to kind of go along as a gopher and a caddy. And about midway through our round, we got the news that the Japanese has attacked Pearl Harbor.
Did that mean anything to you at the time? Did you realize how significant that was?
Not really. I know it wasn't very good for our country, but I don't think I really realized at that time in my life that it was that significant.
You were just about, what, 15 years old then?
Yeah, I think it was about 14, 15, yeah.
So you knew that you wouldn't be going into the service right away?
Well, I wasn't too concerned at that time. Of course, as things went along, it changed.
Did your brother end up in the service before you?
Yes, he did. He went in a little before me and was an Air Force cadet at one time and then went on into the regular Army at a later time.
When did you realize that one way or the other, you were going to end up going somewhere with a uniform on?
Well, actually, my dad, who worked for Standard Oil in Hollister at the time of the breakout of the war, he got transferred up to Napa, California, and I was going to be a senior in the high school, and I felt at that time, the way the war was going, that I was certainly going to reach my 18th birthday and be somewhat involved.
And is that what happened?
Yes, it did. I got drafted in summer of 44 into the Army.
Everybody has a welcome to the Army moment. For some people, it's boot camp was enough to tell them, this wasn't the kind of adventure I was looking forward to. Others, it's that first taste of combat. Was boot camp fun for you as an athlete? Were you prepared for the kind of grueling things they'd put you through?
Yes, actually, having a background being in pretty good shape most of my life and through high school, I got into the Army and there was a lot of physical training and I handled that with ease. And in my background in Hollister, we did a lot of hunting. And when we went on the rifle range, I became an expert with the rifle and so my background kind of led me to somewhat enjoy basic training.
Wow, that is unique. That's a rarity for most of the veterans I talk to. But you talk about your marksmanship. I guess that made you a natural for the Deadeye Division, as the 96th Infantry Division would come to be known as.
Well, I don't know. I think maybe it was just a warm body that they were looking for. But I did cherish the thought of being an expert with marksmen.
Now, have you heard the story of how the 96th Infantry Division came to be known as the Deadeye Division?
Not really. I did not know that history behind that.
Well, I don't know if this is the authoritative version, but what I was able to find in researching it was that Brigadier General Claudius M. Easley, a man with an established reputation as an Army rifle coach and sharpshooter, was eventually named the Assistant Division Commander for the 96th. And so he was determined. He made it his mission to train that division with superior marksmanship. And it's said, at least in retrospect, that the 96th earned that nickname, the Deadeye Division, because of the General Easley and his Deadeye determination to make you guys good marksmen.
Okay.
Had you heard of him before, General
yes,
Easley?
Yes, I've heard of General Easley, yes. I didn't originate with the 96th Division. I joined them on the battlefront in the Pacific as a replacement, so I did not leave the United States with that division.
I got ahead of you then. So what? When did you ship out? Where from, and what were you told at the time? What were your expectations?
Well, actually, I went to basic training down in Texas. When I went to into the service, I was inducted in Monterey at the Presidio Monterey. And at that time, they were assigning recruits to Camp Roberts, which was just down the road about 100 miles by Paso Robles, mm-hmm. and Fort Hood, Texas. And, of course, I was rooting strong to get to Fort Roberts, Camp Roberts, but of course I didn't and got sent to Texas. And from Texas, after basic training, I was sent back to the West Coast to Fort Ord for more training. And then after our training there, we were sent up to Seattle, Washington, Fort Lewis, Washington. And from there, we went on over to the Pacific.
When you're heading out toward the Pacific, what kind of things are going through your mind? Because at this point in the war, you've seen a lot of headlines. You've probably seen some newsreel clips. You know that it's not always pretty out there, and there's some pretty intense things, not to mention the fact that your brother had seen action in Europe.
Yeah. Well, we hadn't communicated all that much between each other, but the longer we got into the shipping overseas and landing on Hawaii and then going on to Saipan, and the further away from home we got, the closer we got to the battlefront. And of course these battles were all going on, Iwo Jima and all those islands out there. And so it got to be a little scary from the standpoint of going into combat.
And when you did go into combat, what was your understanding of what kind of duties you would have?
Well, they weren't really defined. I came out of training as an infantryman, and of course I was assigned, when I got over there, I was assigned to an infantry battalion. But in a battalion, you have four or five companies, and four companies of infantrymen that go right out on the line, and then there's one company that has heavy weapons. And it wasn't my choice. They just said, M Company, heavy weapons, needs X number of guys, and I happened to be one of the guys that were sent there. So I didn't have a choice what I was going to do.
Yeah, it's funny how that works in the Army, huh? They don't always let you tell them what you want to do.
Right.
And they also say never volunteer for anything.
That's right.
In the Army.
I got a story about volunteering.
All right.
I was inducted out of Napa, California, and was sent to San Francisco before we went on down to Monterey, and we were all, a bunch of recruits were in this big hall, just kind of sitting around, and this guy came in, and this sergeant came in, and he says, how many of you guys know how to type? And of course, I was just out of high school, and I'd had a business course, and I could type, so I quickly raised my hand, and so he took us, and we ended up cleaning the latrines in the depot.
There aren't any letter keys on a latrine, as far as I know.
Right.
So they basically just suckered you into volunteering.
Right.
Huh?
That's the last time I volunteered for anything.
I think I would learn that lesson, too, the hard way. That is a good story. Well, I know you have a lot of stories to tell, and we'll take a short commercial break here. When we come back, I want to talk about that first taste of combat in the Pacific, the kind of things that you endured. Being with that heavy weapons unit, I realize you weren't on the front lines, but sometimes being attached to artillery can be even more dangerous because you're a target. They want to take those guns out. So we're going to hear about that, and we're going to save some time at the end of the program to talk a little baseball, too. When you coach at the junior college level and win four state championships in a 31-year career, not to mention some of the great names that you rubbed shoulders with in minor league baseball during your playing days, I know there are a lot of great stories that we'll get to. Coach Len Bordet is our guest today on Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Thank you.
Suns are rolling along today as our show moves on. Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ. Our guest today, an Army veteran of World War II and a legendary baseball coach here in the San Joaquin Valley, Len Bordet, served with the 96th Infantry Division during World War II. When we left off, he had told us about heading over to the Pacific. We were just about to get a taste of his first taste of combat. And it's a battle that I think a lot of people are familiar with, a very bloody battle, one that was pretty drawn out, one that required quite a few replacements. And you were one of those replacements at Okinawa. This was the first time that you got into a taste of combat. Do I have that right?
That's right. We went in there about 5 days after they had landed, Army and the Marines jointly. One branch, Marines went north, the Army went south, and luckily for the Marines, they got the easy end of the island at the beginning. Of course, we all got into it at the end, so there's no gloating over whether we were better than they or not, but it was the way the thing was laid out.
What was going through your mind when you're heading off of a ship, going to shore, and realizing, okay, this is for real. There are going to be guys shooting at me, and it's my job to make sure that that our gun has ammunition to shoot at them. I imagine that's something that kind of keeps you up at night.
Yes, it was somewhat disturbing. We were landing and put us on trucks and headed for the front, and along the way, of course, with the amount of casualties that were being taken there, that many of our comrades were in body bags laying along the road waiting to be taken back to the back area.
And so that's one of the first things that you see when you get there.
Yes, that was...
Your fellow soldiers dead.
Right. So it was somewhat disturbing and, you know, thoughts run through your mind, well, I may be in one of those body bags too before too long. So it was definitely thought-provoking.
And you were assigned as an ammunition runner for a 30 caliber machine gun?
Yes. We had in a squad like that, there's a gunner and a turret carrier, and then there's I think there's six ammunition carriers, and you carry metal boxes of bands of rounds of 30 caliber ammunition.
How heavy of a box are we talking about? How much were you carrying it?
Oh, I would say that they're in the neighborhood of probably 25 pounds, like that. I couldn't tell you actually, but you just carry them very far, you know you're carrying something.
And so you're waiting for a signal from the commanding officer of that squad?
Yeah, well, you usually have the guy on the gun actually, the turret person, he's feeding ammunition in there, and then when he gets low, they call for ammunition, and then who's ever in line takes up what he's carrying, and whatever they need, you try to get it up to them.
What kind of a pace are you taking in such an instance, and what kind of terrain are you having to deal with?
Well, it varies. Usually it's there was very mountainous and rocky, so you were always traversing over rocks and very, very, very little flatland.
Had you spent time growing up in Hollister, going up to the Pinnacles and exploring around there?
Oh, yeah. I've been up to the Pinnacles numerous times, crawled around in the caves up there. And,
so did this compare in Okinawa?
No, it was a lot worse in Okinawa than it is in the Pinnacles.
No one was shooting at you in the Pinnacles.
Right.
What was that like as you're running this ammunition up to the gun or back and forth from wherever you're going? What's the atmosphere? Are there shells flying through the air? Are you hearing constant gunfire? Are you hearing screaming? Describe it for us.
Yes, actually, you know, they say the ones that hit you, you don't hear. But the ones that are missing you have a definite popping and snapping sound when they're going over you. you can really tell. So luckily, I could hear most of the ones that came around me.
Did you get the feeling that it was just a matter of time before one of them did hit you? Is that a thought that went through your mind?
Oh, yeah. There's always, you know, your people in your company, even in your squad, are getting hit either by small arms fire or shrapnel from mortar shells or artillery shells. The thing about heavy weapons, you know, those water-cooled heavy-duty 30s, when you fired them, they would throw up a barrage of steam or smoke, and all of a, you know, that kind of puts a mark on where you're shooting from. So
kind of gives you away, doesn't it?
You don't want to stay in one place too long.
Yeah, I guess that was the advantage of the air-cooled machine guns, huh? They didn't have a cloud of steam.
Yeah, they still smoke a little.
Was it your experience that those, and I know you weren't having to fire the gun yourself, but was it your experience that generally they worked the way they were supposed to, or did you ever have to deal with a crew where it wasn't working?
No, actually, I never experienced, or our gun never seemed to break down or quit working. It always seems to be in good enough repair to do what it was supposed to do, and that was to lay down cover fire for the infantry guys up in front of you.
Probably some of whom were some of your buddies, guys that you'd gone through training with or certainly
sailed over with? Not too many. It's amazing how they can separate you. You know, you go through basic training with a bunch of guys and you hardly ever see them again.
And you hope you don't see them in a body bag.
Yeah, right.
Now, this was a long battle. This was 82 days is how long the battle lasted.
Yeah.
How much of that were you there for?
We were probably in for about 55 days.
That's quite a long time.
Yeah.
Did it seem to be pretty steady as far as the intensity? Were there lulls in the action? Did you ever think, oh, maybe it's almost over?
Yeah, you kind of got that feeling once in a while. There's a little bit of lull, but it seems like when we were on the offensive moving forward, then all of a sudden they would counterattack, and then that would stymie our troops, and we'd have to dig in and try to hold the ground we'd already taken. So it was kind of back and forth for a while.
Now, I imagine if you're there for about 55 days, and that's just about 2 months for those who couldn't quite do that math, there had to be some close calls in there for you. Give me an example of a close call of a time where maybe your position was hit, you were almost hit, or you thought, wow, that was a little too close.
Well, I think the one time that disturbed me the most was that I had become what they called a runner for our company captain, and I was with him, and we were behind a escarpment, and he had his field glasses, and he was looking to see what was going on over in another area, and all of a sudden a bullet from a Japanese sniper caught him dead center on the top of the helmet, and it penetrated right through the helmet, and he deceased at that point right there, and he fell over on top of me.
Holy moly.
And I happened to be down lower than he was. And that was really one of the real disturbing things that I encountered.
Well, if you hadn't been lower than he was, then you might have had one between your eyes, too.
I might have, yes. Yeah, could have.
What do you do in a situation like that? Is it your job then to try to get him back somewhere?
There's always medics out in the field like that. And what you do is you start yelling for medics, and someplace, somewhere, they always seem to show up and take over for the wounded and the ones that are hit very badly.
Now, when something like that happens, and I don't want to dwell on it too much, but is that something that affects you emotionally, or do you try to harden yourself so you're not affected by things like that because you know they're going to happen?
Well, kind of both. I don't think you ever get hardened to the fact that you witness somebody that's close to you getting killed. But it's on your mind, but you still try to perform the duty that you're assigned to do and go on with it the best you can.
I imagine when you're carrying a 25-pound package of ammunition, it's not too easy to reach for a sidearm or anything like that, but I imagine you were armed. You did have weapons.
Oh, yeah, we were armed with usually a small 30-caliber carbine. Mm-hmm. You could sling over your shoulder. And
Did you ever have to use it? Did you ever have to use it?
Not to the extent of actually firing it at a enemy. Yeah.
Just at a rabbit or something?
No. Well, sometimes they ask you to lay a cover of fire, mm-hmm. so you fire out across a certain area. So as far as aiming it right directly at an enemy, no, I never did that.
Now, when did you get the sense that battle was drawing to a close? The war is obviously winding down. The war is over in Europe already. You're still fighting in the Pacific. How did you get the word that this Battle of Okinawa, the biggest amphibious assault in the Pacific during the war, this battle that lasted for 3 months, is finally coming to a close?
Well, you kind of get the feeling as the fighting forces moved down towards the end of the island, that things were beginning to turn in our favor, and we're getting less counterattacks and that sort of thing. So the word filters down pretty quickly in those kind of situations.
Did a moment ever come, and we'll get to a break here again, and we'll talk about the rest of the war for you when we come back, but did a moment ever come in Okinawa where there was some rejoicing that we have victory, this is over, we're leaving, or was it too somber of an occasion?
No, we had those moments of excitement about it being over, and then when it finally was declared secured, we moved into what they called an R&R recreation type of situation, where they allowed us to have some softball games and that sort of thing.
That was right up your alley, huh?
Yeah, I like that.
Well, on that note, we're going to catch another commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the rest of the war for Len Bordet, where he was headed after that and what he thought he'd be doing in August of 1945 when President Truman intervened and changed the war for so many Americans and really for world history. You're listening to Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Tell us about your hometown hero. Email your story by clicking on the Hometown Heroes link at kmj580.com.
Popular choice among the veterans who visit with us on this program, Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition, the great Kay Kaiser, and Pass the Ammunition. That's what Len Bordet was doing in the Pacific during World War II, during the Battle of Okinawa, one of the most famous battles, the last major battle of World War II, an 82-day battle that saw more than 12,000 Allied troops killed, more than 38,000, nearly 39,000 wounded. But Len Bordet, who you might know and probably do know from his years as the head coach at Fresno City College, winning 4 state baseball championships. Go to Euless Park, you see those balls on the wall representing some of his accomplishments in his coaching career. None of that would have happened if he didn't come back from World War II. You heard him talk about the times where he wasn't sure if he was going to come back. A few close calls, but he did survive the Battle of Okinawa. And I understand, Coach, that at the end of that, the battle's over, the island's secure. And you and some of your buddies decided, let's have a little fun. There's these caves. Who knows what's in these caves? Not rattlesnakes like in the Pinnacles, but maybe something more fun. Tell me about what you guys did.
Yes, we were looking for things to do, so 4 or 5 of us decided we'd reconnoiter up in some of the caves that the Japanese has occupied during the battle. And we ran across a medical situation up in the caves, and rummaging around there, we found some things that we'd like to take. And one of them was they had some containers of 100% pure alcohol. So we thought, well, that'd be good. So we dumped all the water out of our canteens and filled them with this alcohol. And we returned to the camp and went down to the mess hall and got some grapefruit mix and stuff from the cook. And we thought we'd have a real big party. And it turned out that we had too much party, and we got rid of that alcohol real fast.
And you probably went to sleep real fast,
yeah,
too. That's some pretty strong stuff. It smells like trouble. But you survived that as well, thank the Lord. And while a lot of the 96th Division got to come home, you didn't have enough points, so you had to stay in the Pacific.
Right. As the war ended, we were shipped down to the Philippines to start training for the invasion of Japan. And on our way down, we were in a convoy, and we got word that the war had ended because of the atomic bomb. And
you'd probably never heard of an atomic bomb before,
never,
right?
Never. And, of course, we were all very excited, but then our excitement kind of turned to fear, because at that particular moment, a wayward Japanese submarine got inside the convoy and started shooting torpedoes at some of the boats. And luckily, we had some Navy vessels that came in and dumped some depth charges and got them out of there. So we were survived that little scare.
What was that like on the ship? Because obviously, you guys aren't trained to defend a ship. You're kind of helpless in that situation, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. You just sit and wait to see if something's going to hit you. So get your life jacket on and see what happens.
Wow, but thankfully, they didn't get you, and the war was indeed over. And you finally got to come home? Did you come home right away?
No, actually, we went on down to the Philippines on the island of Mindoro, where we set up kind of a recreation-type camp. And then I was assigned to the 86th Division. Being an infantryman, I thought I was going to be assigned to the infantry part of that division, but lo and behold, I was assigned to the Ordnance Division of the 86th, and went into working in the motor pool. And actually, I was assigned to re-shoe brake shoes in the motor pool.
That sounds like a fun job.
Yeah.
Didn't come into contact with MacArthur or any of those characters down there, did you?
No, I never did have the opportunity to see MacArthur close up. He was in and around the Philippines a great deal, but I never did see him.
So you didn't rub shoulders with Dugout Doug, but you would spend a lot of time in dugouts in the years that ensued. Do you remember what it was like when you got back home to California, saw your mom and dad again, saw your brother?
Oh, yeah, that was it was a great feeling. Of course, in those days, they were sending us home on ships. And, you know, nowadays you jump on an airplane and matter of depending how far away you are, you're home in hours. It took us about 7 days to get home. So we had a lot of time on the ship. Then when we got back to California, and they assigned us to, I can't remember the name. It was a camp up north of Sacramento for our mustering out situation. So it wasn't a grand and glorious thing. It was just get in there and hopefully to get out.
And then you had a chance to do something that that a lot of people did, and a lot of people of your generation are very thankful for. You got to put the GI Bill to use and go to school.
Yes, that's right. As I said before, my dad had been transferred during the war to Napa, and then when I was in the service, he got transferred to Fresno. And so when I got out of the service, I went to the bus station in Sacramento, and I said, give me a ticket to Fresno. And I'd never been to Fresno in my life. So I got on the bus and came down to Fresno, and my mom and dad picked me up at the bus station. So I was living here in Fresno for a short period of time. And, of course, my thoughts were to get back with my old buddies that I had grown up with in Hollister, who had also been in the service. So I immediately told my mother and dad that I'd like to go back to Hollister and move in with my grandparents and go to San Benito County Junior College. So that's what I did.
Played some sports there?
Oh, yes. I played football, basketball, and baseball there for 1 year.
And that's now known as Gavilan College. And
right.
If I'm not mistaken, they're the Rams, right?
Right.
Yeah, there'll be some Rams in your future, too,
yeah.
At that point. And how did you end up coming to Fresno State? And we'll spend the final segment of this show talking about baseball and all your days in baseball. How did you end up coming to Fresno State and playing for this crazy disciplinarian fundamentalist coach named Pete Biden?
Yeah. Well, actually, one of my best friends, well, there was two brothers in this family, and they were very big in ranching in the Hollister area. And I was working for them in the summer, and one of my very best friends was a good football player. And Kenny Gleason, who was the football coach at Fresno State at that time, recruited him to come to Fresno State to play football. So he, in turn, talked me. My mother and dad were still living in Fresno, so he talked to me about coming over here with him. And so I did. I came back, moved in with my mother and dad, enrolled at Fresno State, and my friend, at that time on the football team, they had a barracks and a mess hall out at Hammer Field. So he was living out there, and I was living with my mother and dad. And naturally, he had a girlfriend in Hollister, and he got very homesick. And after about 3 weeks of football, he decided he would go back and become a gentleman farmer in partnership with his brother and his dad. So he left, and I've been in Fresno ever since.
Yeah, and you got to play for a couple of legends, Pete Biden on the baseball diamond, and Dutch Warmerdam was your basketball coach at Fresno State. You knew who Dutch Warmerdam was, right? You'd probably heard about him while you were getting ready to go overseas. While you were in high school, he was jumping 15 feet on his bamboo.
Yeah, I'd heard the name, but I really wasn't completely aware of what he had done and the things that he had accomplished in his career. But yeah, I'd heard of him.
and I imagine he probably wasn't the kind of guy who would tell you about it either.
No, he was a very humble person, very down-to-earth guy.
He still has one of my favorite quotes that I like to share with World War II pilots sometimes when I talk to them. I got to interview him just probably about a year before he passed away, and he said, you know, the toughest thing about pole vaulting and the trick to it, it's easy to get up, but it's tough getting down.
Yeah.
The landing is the toughest part.
Well, especially in his day when he's going up there and coming down in a pile of sawdust.
Exactly.
You know, now they come down on a nice, puffy landing mat. In those days, they had to keep digging the sawdust up to make it soft.
What was he like as a basketball coach?
He was very intense. He worked us hard, and he tried to get the best out of us. Unfortunately for him, he didn't have all of the greatest talent in the world.
Well, you were a starting forward at 6'2"?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember guarding some guys that were 6'8", 6'7".
Well, I'm sure it taught you a lot, taught you some toughness. And yeah. That experience was put to good use on the baseball diamond and in the coaching profession for years and years. And that's what we're going to talk about when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch. Take another break here, then more with Coach Len Bordet today, Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Long ago and far away, I dreamed a dream one day, and now that
We're here, and so is the voice of Helen Forrest. Haven't heard that for quite a while. Long ago and far away, we've been talking about the World War II experiences of Len Bordet, who served with the 96th Infantry Division, the Dead-Eye Division, which many years later, in 2001, was finally awarded a presidential unit citation for its work in the Battle of Okinawa. You heard Coach Bordet describe what happened after that. He was preparing for the invasion of Japan when the war finally came to a close. And then he ended up back here in the Valley. You heard him talk about playing basketball for Coach Dutch Warmerdam at Fresno State. His baseball coach was the late, great Pete Biden. Spent three seasons, 48, 49, and 50 under Pete. Did it take a week or two for you to get used to his toughness and his style, or had the military prepared you very well for a coach like Pete Biden?
Well, I always enjoyed Pete's workouts because I love to work hard and I love to do the things that he wanted us to do. I can say nothing but praise for my experience under Pete Biden. He just was a coach beyond his before his time. I spent several springs in professional ball and spring training and didn't learn one single thing that Pete hadn't taught me before.
And that is a great compliment to him and his legacy and coaches like you who played for him and then had long, successful coaching careers of your own, I think, are the greatest tribute to his legacy here in the San Joaquin Valley. But before you became a coach, you had a chance to play for some professional ball. You signed with the Cubs after your last year at Fresno State?
Yes, I did. Three of us on that 1950 championship team at Fresno State signed with the Cubs. Galen Bowman, who was just recently inducted into the Fresno State Wall of Fame, and Jack Welton, who has passed away, were all signed by Chicago in the summer of 1950.
Now, I should mention, you mentioned the Wall of Fame, and the dinner for this year's inductees is this Thursday night, October the 23rd, at Pardini's. Tickets are $50 for adults, $20 for children 12 and under. If you don't have your ticket yet, call Ron Schiller. His number is 297-8189. You'll probably hear Coach Batesel talking about that at some point during one of our commercial breaks, too. But 297-8189, if you don't have a ticket yet for the Wall of Fame dinner. Coach Bordet is a part of that Wall of Fame, among several others around the San Joaquin Valley and around the state. And before you stop talking about your 1950 teammates, you guys also deserve some of the credit for what the 51 team did. You guys taught them how to do that, right? The 36-4 1951 team. How much of that was the 50 teams doing?
Well, some of the 50 team went on to the 51 team, but that 51 team, they had a group of ball players that were exceptional. And I can remember as a senior playing against the freshman team, who was basically made up of that 51 team. We had one heck of a time beating them, and they at times beat us. So it was a very talented group.
So you're saying you didn't like hitting against Don Barnett?
No, he hit me in the elbow so many times I had to wear a protective brace.
Well, there would be some other pretty hefty names that you would do battle against as you progressed in your pro career. I came across some statistics from the Northern League in 1952. You played for Sioux Falls, drove in 42 runs that year. A guy playing shortstop for Eau Claire drove in 61 and hit 336. And I understand he beat you out for the All-Star team by one vote at
That's
shortstop?
Right. That's right.
How disappointed were you when you found out you'd been beaten out by one vote for that All-Star shortstop tie?
Oh, I wasn't all that disappointed because I knew that the guy that beat me had a great year. He against us, he was always very good. And the thing about it is he's only 17 years old at the time. So.
And you could tell he was going to be a decent ball player?
He was a hitter, for you could tell. He wasn't hitting that many home runs at that time. But he was a good hitter, and he was a good shortstop.
He wasn't hitting that many home runs at that time, but once he made it to the major leagues, he went on to hit 755 of them.
I think so, yeah.
Tell our listeners who that shortstop who beat you out by one vote was.
Sweet Henry Aaron.
Wow. There's Hammer and Hank in the early days at 17 years old. And is that something that's given you pride since then? As he went on to that tremendous career and became the home run king, is that something that you like to tell that story and remember those days?
Oh, yeah. I always kind of jokingly say that my main claim to fame is coming in second place to Henry Aaron. So.
Well, I think there are a few hundred players who played under you at Fresno City College who might want to give you another claim to fame. You spent 3 years coaching at Sequoia Junior High. Then you got the opportunity to go over to Fresno City College. You spent 31 years there, 4 state championships, including 3 years in a row, 61, 62, 63. Mm-hmm. What did you take away from your time at Fresno City College? What are you most proud of? And I imagine that's a tough question with 31 years worth of baseball teams. But what gives you the biggest smile now looking back on that time?
Well, as the seasons passed, I think as I look back on them, I think the one thing that I probably was most proud of was all the fine athletes that the coaches in the local area sent me, and the consistency that we built up over the years. I think people felt that when they played Fresno City College that they were playing one of the best programs in junior college. And I think in our league, the people in our league felt that to win the league, they had to get by our program. So I think I'm most proud about the consistency. And of course, Ron Scott has done a magnificent job of maintaining that and even elevating it to a new status.
And this past year, he passed you up in terms of career wins.
That's right.
What was that moment like for you?
Oh, it was great. I was rooting for him, and he says I really didn't want to do it, Coach. And I said, come on now, you know you did.
And then you tell him he still needs a few balls on the wall to catch you for state titles. Huh?
Yeah, he's behind me in that category, but that's about the only category that he is behind.
The other thing people, if they go to a baseball game at Euless Park, will find are all the names on the right field wall of guys who played in the Fresno City College program, many of them for you, who went on to the major leagues. Names like Tom Seaver, Jim Maloney, Mark Gardner toward the tail end of your career. Who was the guy in all those years that just had the best stuff, the guy that was, when you went out there to a game, you knew he was going to win? Maybe there's a few of them, but was there someone that you just really marveled at?
Yeah, there isn't any doubt. I have to say Dick Selma was, without a doubt, the most consistent for 2 years of anybody I've ever had there.
You were telling me that at the Fresno High Wall of Fame dinner recently, they talked about what kind of rotation the Warriors could have had from all the years. Yeah. Your FCC Ram starting rotation would be pretty impressive, too, huh? You could put a Tom Seaver, a Maloney, a Gardner. Who else would you put in that? Dick Selma. So that's 4 out of 5 right there.
Yeah, and, of course, we had Bobby O'Brien, who got to the big leagues with the Dodgers in Baltimore, and Danny Boy Tano, who got to the big leagues with a couple clubs, and Steve Ellsworth, Dick's mm-hmm. son, got to the Red Sox. So we've had a legacy of good pitching at Fresno City College.
For years and years, and pretty good hitters, too. We just had a few moments left here in the program. You're still a young man, 82, do I have that right?
That's right.
So you're out on the golf course several days a week?
Yeah.
How many holes in one have you hit?
13.
13 holes in one.
Yeah.
And how many times have you shot better than your age?
I think it's 298 at this moment.
Now, that might be a record. I wonder if the Guinness Book has a record for that.
No, it's not a record. I've heard guys back in Florida have done it something like 400 or 500 times. So, but I'm proud of what the times I've done it. And the first one I did was when I was 73 years old.
Wow!
I shot 73, and then and from that time on, I've kept a record of it. So that's just how I.
Good for you. Well, I hope you have 298 more of those, if not more, and I won't be surprised if you do. Thanks so much for coming in. Thank you for your service to our country and to our valley for all these years. Len Bordet was our guest today. We'll be back with another edition of Hometown Heroes next week here on News Talk 580 KMJ.